To see examples of what we talk about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
Song, you know this voice. Did you miss me? I know you didn't, because honestly, the last two episodes were freaking amazing. Awesome interviews, awesome creators. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. It is Rook. I am so glad to be back. I'm so sorry I missed you guys so much. Joining me as always is the man himself, the guy who kept everything going while my life was going haywire. Ladies and gentlemen, say hello to Don Moore.
Hello.
Don, I missed you, man. I mean, we've actually been talking for probably a good half an hour just off recording, just catching up with each other, because just we haven't actually had more than text message conversations in, well, over a month. So it's great to be back. I missed you. Some amazing stuff that you've gotten to talk to, some amazing creators. I really hope that they come back and I get a chance to chat with them myself.
Yeah,
but
I do too.
We're here. It's just me and you, man.
Yeah, it's been a while. I missed the creators coming on has been fantastic, but sometimes
and
it's nice.
We've got some great creators too.
Yeah. And we do have more coming up, but,
yes.
And that's a good problem to have. I'll be honest with you. I'm kind of wondering where all these people found,
Well, keep finding us, guys, because we're loving what you're doing. You know, the creation of art, the creation of comic books is just a fantastic thing. We absolutely love it. And, you know, let's dig in. Let's talk comic books, man. I really, really want to talk to you about something that we've actually talked about before. Ready for this?
Okay.
The Kickstarter came in for A Hunter's Tale.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yes. I backed it. This is absolutely okay. So first off, everybody remembers we talked to Ryan Clater on an earlier episode, Elephant Eater Comic Books. This came in actually right about as like life went sideways over here. So I was able to pop it open. I was able to read the book. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's everything we thought it was going to be.
Oh, that is nice.
Beautiful, beautiful piece of work. You know, Don and I have been in printing and design. Yeah. And this is a weird printer kind of thing, okay? But this book smells nice.
Yeah, yeah.
It smells like fresh printing, which is something that just, I don't know. For guys who ever worked in a print house, there's something about the smell of a fresh print that just – I love it. And, you know, like the first thing I noticed when I pulled it out of the plastic was – which it came in its own awesome little, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's even got plastic and board sized for this book. I love it. For those who don't remember, this is – A Hunter's Tale is a comic poem – by his grandfather, Charles Kermit Clator. Ryan Clater made this book as a loving homage to his grandfather's poem, which the poem is in the back of the book. You can actually read the original piece
in
the back
too.
Of the book, so that is preserved in there as well. But what a fantastic piece. You know, I don't want to ruin it because I really want you guys to go and check it out. You can, you can go check out Elephant Eater Comic Books, or ElephantEater.com, actually. Check that out. Just absolutely gorgeous piece, and it just – it's a beautiful, beautiful thing that he wrote here, that he created. I really, really love this book. And Don, let me tell you, the Kickstarter that he sent, first off – you know, it came in this great package. It was well packaged, well done. It had a little note in it thanking me for the support.
Yeah, nice.
That was awesome. That was very cool. Another thing that it came with, immediately noticed, was Inside there was a art piece. Okay, it's a numbered art piece. I got number 253 out of 500. Okay, it is autographed as well. There's a bookmark and a sticker.
All right.
You know I love my stickers.
Yeah.
So that was all inside of the packaging, and then inside that I had to rip this open, but this. It's a paper protector that he made, and he taped it into the heavy board that everything was inside of. Yeah. So he did a fantastic job packaging this to make sure it got to the Kickstart supporters safely. Yeah. It came in perfect condition, and it even came with a cute little one page piece. Okay. There's a little comic book here. It's an illustration of him. There's a surprise here. Please accept this extra copy of A Hunter's Tale. Which, Don, I have an extra copy just for you, buddy.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah. He sent an extra copy of the book. I mean, this guy's fantastic. I love it. You know, like I said, I can't tell you guys how fantastic this comic is. The illustration in it, the print quality, absolutely just fantastic. You know, when we talked to these guys, and we only got like what, an 8 to 10 page preview of this book.
Yeah.
So you know, we had an idea of where he was going with it, but it gets so much deeper, and it's really a beautiful thing that he wrote here, and that he and his grandfather wrote. So I can't recommend this enough. Elephant Eater Comics, you know, elephanteater.com. Brian did a fantastic piece with this book, and you know, the little mini size of it, you know, it's fun. You know, it's like it's a pocket size piece, you know, like the old poetry books.
Right.
So I adore this. I absolutely love this, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what other work he has coming down the pipe in the future.
It's a lot thicker than I was expecting it to be as well.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, the pages are, we got numbered pages here. There's a total of 25 pages. 27, because at the very end he does have a picture of assuming him and his grandfather there, you know. The comic itself I would technically say the comic is 21 pages, okay? And I don't want to go into why I say technically 21 pages, right, because I want you guys to buy this. So, but it's really, you know, this is a great interaction between Hunter and Deer. And, you know, it's what's interesting to me is growing up the way I did, my father was a hunter. Many people in my family hunted. My boss was a hunter. Still has his old tree stand and everything, which is just a massive, crazy heavy tree stand compared to what they make these days.
Yeah.
There's kind of a connection here made between between his grandfather and the deer, and it's something I've actually heard echoed before with other people. So, you know, it was very interesting to see it put into words beyond just casual conversation, and then to see it illustrated the way it was. You know, it's a fantastic piece. A Hunter's Tale, again, elephanteater.com. I really want you guys to go check this out. You know, those of you who heard that episode and were like, "This sounds cool." You know, yes, it is. It's absolutely cool. And, you know, definitely go out and grab this.
Here's another tie-in with it. You know, you kept talking about the coin-op carnival. You know, Dallas read about that.
Yes.
I Mal, who was the head dork with a bunch of dorks, he did a Slow Robot a Go-Go on the original Bunch of Dorks show.
Right.
Martin, Mel has a big collection of pinball machines. He's always going, when he lived here in Florida, he used to go to all these shows, you know, getting parts and stuff, refurbishing them. And I just told him, we had a guy on the show that has a book called Coin Up Carnival.
Mm-hmm.
Guess who has it?
Yeah, really?
And
That's awesome.
You know, because he said, I saw that you guys posted, you know, he follows the bunch of dorks, the Two Dimension. I saw you guys had him on there. And he said, I said, how did you know about this? Well, it was a contest with another podcast about pinball machines, and he won the book. And he loved it. He was talking about it. Okay, so Ryan Clater gets around.
Man, that's fantastic, you know. So he is known. He is known amongst our circle. I love it, man, you know. But, yeah, excellent guy. Had a great time talking to him, you know, and this book is absolutely fantastic. Like I said, there's certain nuances to the story that like I said, I've heard echoed by other people. So it was fascinating to see it put into these words, this illustration, and you know, I really love his art style, the coloring, you know, the size of it. The size of it is just so great. I mean, this is like as big as my hand.
And,
You know, it's just a different style of packaging. It's a different, it's a wholly different piece into my collection now.
Nice.
You know, this is going to be a fun book that I'm afraid people are going to want to borrow, and I'm going to be, I'm going to be a bit of a, no, go buy it yourself. So, but yeah, the bookmark's great. And like I said, the sticker. So it's, you know, I love talking to these creators and, you know, backing their projects and getting to see the final pieces after we get to chat with them and stuff, man. This has been a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah, it's been a blast. And it's strong work, too. I mean,
I like the variety
of it. You know, it's not like, I'm going to say this, I do like house styles. You know, some publishers have a house style. And even though it's not the case now, Image Comics absolutely had a house style in the early 90s.
Yes.
You know, it not now, but there was an Image style to it. But I like all kinds of stuff. And that's one thing I liked. You and I have talked about in the past is a lot of web comics. You know, basically it's everything but the kitchen sink. Any kind of style you can think of. And that's been kind of what we've been going through. We've got some that seem a little more mainstream than others, but they're always good, and some of them have come out of left field.
Like, yeah,
I didn't see this one coming.
Like Path of the Pale Rider. Man, what a great conversation that was, you know. And then, you know, Crit, you know, I'm going to jump back on you guys here. I apologize. I know you've all listened to the episodes, but I want to make some commentary real quick. Crit, I really look forward to getting a chance to talk to him myself because, you know, from one DM to another, you know, what he's done there is absolutely fantastic. You know, taking your D&D games, your RPG game, gaming, and turning it into a comic book, that's a heck of a feat. And, you know, to have to self-edit some of the conversations, the dice rollings, things like that. And, you know, in his books, he doesn't put the tropes in. Like when I was looking over his work, you know, you almost expect to have, like, you know, maybe like a die sitting on a page somewhere, And I didn't see that. So yes, it's created through RPGs, you know, sitting at the table, playing the game. But he doesn't use it as like tropes in his artwork.
No.
Or if he does, he hides it greatly. I mean, and then Path of the Pale Rider, I mean, that is just what a universe she has created. I digress. I'm sorry. I know you guys all listened to those episodes, and I missed it, but I just wanted to comment on that stuff real quick because I love those conversations that you had with those creators, yeah. And I'm really bummed that I missed it.
Well, they said they'd come back, and I'm holding them to it. Yes. I really enjoyed it, and that was the thing I was wishing you were there. But, yeah, I was nice. I was going to start something off. I was talking to Scott Connor. Hi, Scott. But
hi, Scott.
We've talked about this in the past, was the eras of comics. You know, you always hear about the Golden Age, the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, mm-hmm. and the Modern Age. It was one of the early episodes we were talking about them. I didn't know there was still only four ages. You know, you were the one that looked it up and said, we're still in the modern age. Now, I always call my favorite time was the early 80s. Well, all the 80s, especially the early 80s, because that's when you started getting all these independent books, you know, publishers coming out, and it was, to me, just a plethora of awesome. I always call that the age of plastic, just because the 80s seemed plastic, the music seemed plastic, which I loved. But, come to find out, that was still the Bronze Age. The Golden Age is always... Comics started in 1933. Eastman Color was putting out Famous Funnies. Mm-hmm. And they were reprints of newspaper comic strips. But it was in 36, 37? The first issue of Action Comics came out with Superman. And my date may be off, but it was in the late 30s. And they say that's when the Golden Age started. And the Silver Age was 1956 when DC Comics, at the time was called National Periodical Publications, put out the Showcase introducing the Barry Allen Flash, the Red Flash. And that's what Alan Moore called the science heroes. And then you got the new Green Lantern, the Hal Jordan Green Lantern, and, you know, everything was based on science fiction. Also, you could argue that the first issue of Fantastic Four, which is in 61, was another harbinger, but usually it's 56. the Bronze Age started in 1970, mm-hmm. and they say... It depends on who you listen to. Most people say it's when Jack Kirby left Marvel and went to DC and started his Fourth World stuff, which makes sense. Other people say it's when Marvel started publishing Conan, which makes sense too. Those are major changes. And that's, to me, at the time, they were hippie heroes. You never saw that stuff in 1970. Even the Fourth World stuff was just... The first time I ever saw any of that was... Mr. Miracle and Big Barda was in it. He was one of my favorite characters, but those looked like hippie characters. And anyway, the modern age began... Most people say now it's Watchmen, but it was when Frank Miller was doing Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen in 1986, and we're still in the modern age to this day.
Right.
There's a really good podcast called Comic Book Historians I listen to. And one of the guys in the show, I think he has eight ages. He's divided up more, you know, more detail. And which I see where he's coming from. It gets kind of confusing to me. But I started a project. It was on the sidebar of the blog. I ended up moving it to its own page. And it's the four eras of comic books. And I got all the publishers from each era listed, and there's links. If you want to see it, you can click on it. One that blew my mind was in the Golden Age, there was a publisher called Ziff Davis. And they used to do men's magazines, and I've seen them on Facebook. They're kind of racy and scary. There's like a guy in the, you know, out in the plains or in the jungle with a knife and a wild animal's attacking him. Or crazy locals, and, you know, there's usually a scanty-clad woman scared to death, all 50s-looking styles, 40s, 50s. But Ziff Davis is doing comic books, which I've seen them online. They're still around. Dallas has bought comics from them. And I bet he doesn't even know it. Ziff Davis is not called Ziff Davis anymore, if they are, but they're not publishing comics that way. They do the Humble Bundle that Dallas always gets online.
Yes, yeah.
What's interesting, if you look at those links, the Golden Age, there's so many comic publishers that just appeared. It's like when it rains and mushrooms appear everywhere. And then when you look at the Silver Age, not much. Now, some of those were still around during the Silver Age. The Bronze Age, I don't know. When I was reading comics as a kid, there wasn't, it seemed like in the 60s, there were some Tower Comics, there was some, but it kind of stopped in the 70s. And then as the 70s went on, all of a sudden you started getting all these independent alternative publishers, but they weren't usually on newsstands. They were in head shops, places like that. And then later when the comic shops, the first comic shop I ever saw was in Oklahoma City. It was down Memory Lane in 1975, which is really hard to get to because I had to beg my mom to take me there. And I think I only went there 4 or 5 times. But I didn't know they had all these different comics. I never saw Star Reach. I never saw Zap Comics, which, you know, growing up in the Bible Belt and you're, you're not even a teenager yet, it's like going blind when you saw some of those covers. But then after that was the Modern Age. Quite a few publishers have appeared. Anyway, I was talking to Scott Connor. We're talking about that. And he said, that's why I'm starting this conversation off, he never agreed with the eras. What he always saw was decades. If you went by the decades. And okay. when he said that, that's the first thing I didn't realize it. That's how I've always thought. Because you have, even though comics around in the 30s, and Superman appeared and Batman appeared, I think, in 39. But the comics, to me, really, the Golden Age was the 40s. And then you had the 50s comics, even though the Silver Age began at the end of the 50s. But to me, those were the 50s comics. The 60s comics were, again, what? Yeah. To me, what?
Yes. So I see what you're saying here. And, yeah, I kind of look at more like the decades, too. Like, I look at, like, the 40s and 50s as the Golden Age.
Yeah.
And, to me, I've always thought the Silver Age never really started until the 60s.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then the Bronze Age would have been, like, the 70s. On through the 80s, and then the 90s is really, you know, late 80s early 90s is when the Modern Age, what we see now as the comic book industry, started. But you know, I really think we're in a whole different age of comic books now. Yeah. You know, because let's look at what's happening in modern times, comparatively to like the 80s and 90s. We have not just smaller publication houses, but these smaller publication houses are putting out books that can rival and take away the sales of the major houses, you know. So we're really in, you know, a renaissance age of comic books. You know, and you know, if anybody wants to run with that, I'd like to be credited for calling it the Renaissance Age of Comics. you know, we're seeing such a surge and such a an increase in interest in the medium. You know, it's fantastic to me. I absolutely love what's happening in comics today. You can literally find comic books for any interest these days. If you want to, you know, do, you know, Western comics, sci-fi comics, anything is out there, and it's all available to us. Unlike the other ages where, you know, the Golden Age really, you know, it was the start of the superhero, but it wasn't the focus of comics, yeah. Really. The Silver Age was the really, that's when the superhero took over the comic books industry. you know, through you know, during the Silver Age of comics, I mean, yeah, there were other things other than just superheroes, but that was really all there was.
Yeah.
The Bronze Age, just absolutely, there was nothing but superhero comic books. You know, pretty much if you didn't have spandex and tights on, nobody paid attention. You know, and then the modern age of comics, you know, we saw the birth of a whole new style of anti-heroes, human interest stories. And now we're in this new age, if you ask. In my personal opinion, I think we're in a new age of comics where there's literally something for everybody. You know? You don't have to just be a superhero fan. Comics aren't focused purely on the detective or the superhero. Like I said, there's something for everybody in this age of comic books.
Yeah, what you said is well said. One thing I was going to say was in the 40s, when we're reading books about comics, they're always telling you about the superheroes. But there were a lot of different kinds of comics that people don't talk about now.
Mm-hmm.
And but I always look at the 40s, there were superheroes defending neighborhoods.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. There were the Guardian, which is the Simon Kirby character, who came back when Kirby went to his Fourth World War. But he was a policeman, and all these kids were running around, you know, getting the wrong influence. So he went and made his own costume and became the Guardian. And basically he protected Mr. Terrific, another DC character, was the same way. But they were usually costume heroes defending the neighborhood. I've said this on the show before, watching Bruce Lee's movies in the 70s, I was thinking he'd be some type of James Bond international guy trying to save the world. And even though I love the movies, I was disappointed that he was defending a Chinese restaurant or defending a neighborhood that had an ice business.
Yeah.
I'm like, wait a minute, what?
Something more grandiose.
Which, I mean, don't get me wrong, those movies are awesome. It wasn't what I was expecting. I was expecting Bruce Lee to be in Star Wars.
And, dude, can you imagine?
That'd But the 60s, you know, and the 50s, people look back at the 50s and they see the resurgence of the Flash and the Green Lantern and all this stuff, but because of the Comics Code, superheroes were kind of gone. DC always published Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman because Superman and Batman sold really well. Wonder Woman actually didn't sell that well, even though people think it did. Mm-hmm. It's just that if they didn't continually publish it, it went back. The rights went back to the Marston estate.
Yeah.
So they kept it. But, and I guess Aquaman was printed in the back of one of those magazines. They tried to keep some of the characters going. But they had war comics. They had horror comics, but they weren't horror with vampires or anything. They were more of the thrillers, you know, the scary, you know, the thinking kind.
Mm-hmm.
They had dog comics. They had Ren Tin Tin. There was Lassie. There was, what was that secret agent dog? There was a lot of dog comics and cowboy comics. And if you look at but when I see the 60s, I think of the cosmic hero. That's when Jack Kirby was doing all the stuff with Marvel.
Yeah.
And they weren't DC had the science heroes. Marvel was all cosmic stuff. And but what was that book, Jack Kirby, King of Comics, I think it was called? We all have it.
Yes.
If you read through that, what makes it interesting, if you ever read the history of Marvel Comics, they basically say the Fantastic Four came out and then all these other superheroes came out. And they did, but they didn't. They were still doing the big monster tales. They were still doing the Twilight Zone kind of, science fiction-y thriller tales that were scary, which I loved. they were doing all the cowboy comics. Jack Kirby, you know, Rawhide Kid, what was it, Two Gun Kid? What was the other one? There was three of them. But they were doing those. They were doing Sergeant Fury and the Howling Commandos.
Yeah.
And it was years before some of these superhero comics were coming out. There was a lot of different comics. But I think of the 60s as the science and cosmic heroes. The 70s... The 70s was kind of a...
weird time?
Well, when I moved here to Florida, it was in 87. And I was reading in the newspaper, they had a music critic talking, and he says that when he looks back at the 70s, all he sees is a decade in polyester, something he doesn't even want to look back on. Well, when I read at the time, I was thinking that too, but there was a lot of great music in the 70s. Some people argue there was more good music in the 70s than there were at any other time. Even though the 60s were great and stuff, a lot of music was happening.
Hey, Kiss came from the 70s.
Yeah, well, I mean, Led Zeppelin, their first album came out in 69. They were around in the late 60s, but the 70s was Zeppelin's decade. You know,
absolutely.
So there may be some bands that came out in the 60s, but they were really 70s bands. But a lot of people look back at the 70s as the ugly decade. You know, the Vietnam War ended. You know, Nixon got, you know, was going to get impeached. The whole Watergate thing. OPEC stopped selling oil to us. He had the fuel oil, you know, the oil crunch. And there was a lot of things, and then there was a big recession. Hostage crisis in Iran. There was a lot of things that we basically felt hopeless to. And the heroes were... they were heroes, but they were kind of... Superman lost half his powers. The books didn't make sense because they had three different editors for the Superman books. There was Superman, there was Action Comics, and World's Finest. Three different editors, and they didn't follow what each other was doing. So in the Superman books, there was a sand creature that looked like Superman. He was slowly turning from a sand Superman to a regular Superman. That's where half of his powers went to. And Superman is just grasping. He made mistakes. He failed. As a 9-year-old kid, I didn't like that. You know,
yeah.
Wonder Woman lost all of her powers and turned into Diana Rigg. You know, Diana Rigg was with an old show called The Avengers, which was really cool, but Wonder Woman's better. And but a lot of civil rights issues going on in these books. People throwing rocks and bottles at the superheroes. The Marvel characters, everybody seemed to hate them. The police were after Spider-Man. You know what I mean? The Age of Innocence was kind of gone. And then, to me, the 80s... to me, it was a bright time. He started getting with the mainstream books. George Perez was doing all of his stuff. You know, he'd been doing the 70s, but he was doing Teen Titans. He was doing all that work. He had Frank Miller doing the Daredevil work, which was... I got the Daredevil books. I was in college. I was 300 miles away from home. I went to college in a town that didn't have any comic stores. And a lot of the convenience stores didn't carry comics there. So one time my brother came down to visit me, and my parents stopped at the comic store and picked up the books the guy was saving, so I had a stack of books I read. And I had two issues of Daredevil, which wasn't a book I really liked at all. You know, I'd read it when friends of mine would have it. And I went, why did he send me this? And I glanced through it and said, this isn't what I like. Well, when I worked my way through the pile I had those two Daredevil issues left, and I wanted to read a comic, so I said, all right, I'll read it. Oh, my God. You know, it wasn't a finished style I liked, but just reading it was a completely different experience of anything I ever went through. And then, all of a sudden, Pacific Comics came out. They started doing all the Bruce Jones, Twisted Tales, Alien Worlds, the Craig Russell, Elric stuff. The Rocketeer came out with Dave Stevens. Fantagraphics started doing Love and Rockets, which is to this day my favorite comic. Drew the Wanderer came out, which is my favorite comic. Usagi Jimbo came out, you know, which that's another favorite comic. But you started getting Delgota, Mr. X, Time Spirits, just anything, you know. They weren't superhero. A lot of them were superhero comics, but not all of them. You know, they were science fiction, they were fantasy, they were metaphysical. I absolutely loved the 80s. And then a lot of those publishers, I guess, were making some money, and then they stopped making money, and then the 90s came around, and that's when you got the Image Comics work. And big money being made. You started seeing some creators retain the rights when they created Image Comics, and they all became millionaires.
Well, most of them became millionaires.
Yeah, well, I like the fact of that. I've never looked at the business side of comics. I'm always surprised that I read about the 70s. Two cartoonists I really like is Mark Hempel and Gene Wheatley. I think his name is Mark Wheatley. No, they're both Mark. Mark Hempel and Mark Wheatley. And in the 80s, they did a comic I love called Mars. Now, they're still doing work. We talked about it on the show. But I guess in the mid to late 70s, as young men, they went to Marvel Comics to get work. Mm-hmm. And John Romita looked at their portfolio and says, "Look, guys, this is really good stuff. I appreciate it. I wish you luck, but I can't hire you. I'm having trouble getting work to the people I have now." I didn't know that they were afraid comics were going to collapse under its own weight. They weren't selling enough. It's when Marvel Comics got Star Wars. It's what pulled Marvel out of bankruptcy. I never knew that. I didn't really understand when the 90s were going on. I mean, all I saw was Image was just raking money in hand over fist, had tons of titles. Back when the internet was new, you used to get those AOL discs in the mail. So I thought I'd try it. So I put it in. This is all dial-up. You know, it's slow. But I'm waiting for AOL to come up. And you'd have these little placeholders that say Image. I said, "What, Image Comics is here too?" I didn't realize it was waiting for the actual Image.
That's funny.
But that was the world we were living in. Image ruled the world at the time, as far as if you're looking through a comics filter. And then it all came crashing down. But saying that, there were still comics I loved getting at the time. I never stopped loving the comics. After the 90s, to me, I kind of have trouble putting the decades in a filter, I guess. I looked at the 90s as basically comics on steroids with explosions everywhere. You know,
like,
after that...
Like a space film.
Well, you know, and when you talk about people that were growing up at the time, they talk with great love and enthusiasm. The guy that we just talked to that did Crit was talking about that. You know, the 90s comics that he loved, all the Image stuff, that's what they got from it. But since then, I mean, there's tons of comics that came out after that, but it's kind of, to me, somewhat like the 80s were, where it's a whole plethora of different stuff, and I guess it depends on what direction you're looking at as to how to categorize each decade now.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, like I said, you know, the medium has become so mixed now, you know, it's... You can actually find people who talk about, like, multiple eras of comic books. Like, I've found people who have, you know, the Victorian, the Platinum Age, as well as the Golden, Silver, Bronze, Modern. You know, I just referenced the current age of comics as the Renaissance Age of Comics. You know, everybody's going to have their opinion on the different ages of of the comic book industry. You know, we have these quote unquote accepted ages, but you know, the truth is you know, what age is the best? Well, whatever age of comic books you came into,
yes,
or whatever age of comic books you preferenced your reading material from. You know, there is no best age of comic books. It's subjective.
Yes.
You know, just like, you know, as we were talking about, like, the different ages of comics, we see the timeline a little bit differently. So, you know, historically, you know, the modern age of comic books started in precisely 1980. Guys, let's not get bogged down by the semantics of the age of comics. Let's love the medium for what it is, you know. Let's enjoy the variation of the time frames, you know. Let's look at the greats of our past in the gold and silver age, and realize that we wouldn't be here now without them, you know. To me, the different ages of comic books, the history of comic books, it's, you know, it's something to treasure, but it's not something to micromanage.
Yeah.
I think we can all have a wonderful disagreement or agree to disagree in our understanding of when the different ages started or ended. You know, and I'm sure there's going to be somebody that's going to be like, no, you're wrong. Precise age of comics is from A to B to C to D. I don't hear collectors talking so much about the age of comics as I do what I'm going to unlovingly refer to as comic book profiteers.
Oh, yeah.
You know, yeah. Collectors like us, we'll talk about, you know, yeah, in the 60s, the blah, 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 you know, or, you know, we'll talk about a creator's run on a particular series, you know, but the comic book profiteers, you know, the ones that, you know, are trying to drive up the price of some book that they found at a garage sale that they believe to be worth, you know, $1 million. You know, they're the ones that are going to concentrate on the gold, silver, bronze age of comic books, you know. I think as collectors and readers of comic books, you know, we should look at the overall picture.
Yeah, so, I agree.
Like, just for an example, you know, I point out the comic book profiteer and the garage sale, you know, buyer. I actually had a whole bunch of comics sitting out in front of my house one time during a garage sale. And I was selling them to the neighborhood kids.
Right.
I was like, you know, bring me a dime and you get like five of them, kid.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you know. And I had this guy, this skeevy, creepy dude show up at my yard sale and start like explaining to me the ages of comics. You know, well, see, what I'm looking for, man, is stuff from the 1950s and 60s. And I was like, you're looking for the golden silver age of comics? Yeah, that's exactly it, man. You know, that's the stuff that, you know, I'm really those are the things that I'm looking for. And I was like, yeah, you're not gonna find anything there. Yeah. And I told the guy, I was like, you know, that's all like late 80s, early 90s comic books sitting in that box. Those are for the kids. And he's like, well, you know, you obviously know your comics, so maybe we'll take a walk inside. You got a collection?
Like, get out of here.
No, dude, get out of here. You know? Like, I'm not going to let some skeevy dude in my house to rifle through my comic collection. Get out of here. You know? So that's what I call the comic book profiteer, you know, that's the guy that focuses on the gold, the silver, the bronze ages, you know. I think as collectors and readers and those who enjoy comics, I don't really think we should focus on that stuff, you know?
I agree with you. Nevertheless, I have it on the blog.
it's great for the history and for the understanding, you know, of during this time frame, these publishers were the ones that were active in making the books, and, you know, I think that's fantastic, you know. Let's face it, at our core, we are a history of comics podcast, you know. We talk about where it came from, who it came from, you know, stuff like that. So the history is important. I'm not blowing it off, but, you know, I want people to understand that that's not the only thing you need to focus on.
Right. Well, the reason this conversation is going on was I put that on a sidebar. It's a blog post, but there's no show connected to it. So I added it on a sidebar, so if you want to read it, you can just click on that. It'll take you to the page. Scott Connor sent me a link to a piece he wrote, and basically, like Rook, he was poo-pooing on the whole thing of ages. And it's it's really cleverly written, and it's funny, and he plays with words, he ties things in. I really enjoyed it, and I asked him, do you mind if I put that on the page? This is a go-ahead. So, if you click on the page on the sidebar, it's the four errors of comic books. At the very, at the top, it has the four errors. And I've got, you got the links to all the publishers on there, so if you have any interest, you can click on those. Underneath that is Scott's comments. It's hilarious. And when it starts, he talks about ages of comics. I link that to, I'm just mentioning the comic book historians, but the guy has, I think, eight ages. So you click and see what that man is written. Anyway, that's all on the on the blog, on the sidebar. And when what Rook was saying, I kind of went through that, because everybody talks about the superheroes in the 70s. But in the 60s and 70s, really popular comics that I love were Harvey comics. You know, Richie Rich, Hot Stuff, Casper the Friendly Ghost, Wendy the Witch. I love those. And if I see those in dollar boxes, I grab them. They just make me happy. Warren Krimmer drew most of them. Ernie Colon was another one that I loved. Howie Post, there was Sid Crouchy. There was a bunch of artists that I really, to this day, enjoy those stories. I think they're some of the greatest comics ever done. I had Charlton comics. A lot of them were funny animal stuff. And I bought Archie comics. Once in a while, I still pick some up. I love the Archie comics. When I was in college, I was broke, and I kind of wanted some money, and so I took about half of my collection and tried to sell it at a guy at a convention. This is 1981 in Oklahoma City. And the guy looked through it, and he kept telling me I should put my X-Men in because they'd bring the price up. Over my dead body. You know, this is the Dave Crockerum, John Byrne X-Men, you know, that I had. Wasn't going to happen.
There's certain ones, like, if you're trying to, you want to cash in on your collection and grab a couple bucks, there's certain ones you're just not going to get rid of.
Well, and there was, I had another box separately, and I said, this is my Kirby's. This is 1981, and I really hated to get rid of them. I had a lot of them in reprints, but the guy just said, Kirby, he's just not selling. His time's past. He says, somebody just came up and had an entire run of Good New Gods. And he says, we could just give him $50. Well, okay. But that's the thinking. Jack Kirby was past. He was, and the stuff was, the early Marvel stuff was selling. But anyway, we went inside the convention again. He went to his partner and talked to him. And it was almost like code when he's telling his partner what I had. And I remember one thing he was saying was, He's got some superheroes. He's got funny animals. He's got teenage comics. He's got, but he basically talked about all these comics that I love. They kind of basically, and they did explain to me later that that stuff they just have to give to some guy at a flea market for a penny a piece. And they were looking for certain key issues. I understand they're businessmen, but I never separated. I loved them all, and I don't think you should just be, well, if you like it. But I noticed in the mid-2000s when MySpace was a thing, whenever you saw any kind of, or a blog, a MySpace page or a blog, people were only putting key issues. When the Punisher appeared, when Wolverine appeared in the Hulk, you know, you know, certain things, the Green Lantern, Green Arrow drug issue, you know what I mean, which were neat. But that's all they had. There was one guy that I met from New Zealand on MySpace, and basically his MySpace page looked like my collection when I was 10 years old. He had Charlton comics, and not key issues, I mean just stuff that I had in my collection. To me, that's comic books. If you enjoy reading it, it doesn't matter what the comic book is, it warmed and illuminated somebody's childhood, and probably even to this day. So, but I wanted to do that mostly just to show the publishers. Also, it gives you an idea of how many appeared in the Golden Age, and then how many started appearing, I was surprised, at the end of the Bronze Age, and then how many have been going on since. Also, at the very bottom, I said outside the mainstream, and I had the five underground publishers, which I thought was a lot more. The underground publishers were something odd, and you run into this. You inherited a bunch of comic books, and you had a Zap Comics. You were kind of jumping up and down. Underground comics.
I was thrilled by that, man.
Yeah, well, I was always wondering about it because you could go to any head shop or when I moved here to Florida, down in Pasadena, you know, in St. Pete Beach, they had a really good beach store called, I think it was Out of Sight Shop. And it was turned into a place where you got suntan oil and towels and swimsuits and t-shirts. But they had some records. People that grew up here was telling me that before it was one of the greatest head shops in the world. But they had a lot of stuff that Bud Plant sold, metal signs, you know, and they had a little wall of underground comics. I bought some. I got some Zap Comics and Mr. Natural. But there were multiple printings of all those comics. So the stuff that you could buy in the 60s, you missed it, well, you could get them in the 80s. You could get them in the early 90s. They kept them in print. And sometimes you could get the 9th or the 15th printing of them, but I didn't realize there was really only 5 underground publishers. So anyway. And if you do go to the page and you have anything you want corrected or added, just send a note. We have a contact page, and feel free to send any corrections, and I'll add it if I can, or change it if I can.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's have a music break.
Hey guys, this is Dallas Busha, and this next song is from my EP Moral Compass, which you can find anywhere that you stream music, and the name of the song is The Sound of Isolation. You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
Your Dimension can be found on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe, rate, leave a review, tell a friend, or like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
All right. Well, we've covered the four eras of comics and all the opinions.
And beyond.
So, now you said you read a couple of books. You talked about the Ryan Clater book. What else
yes,
you got?
Talked about A Hunter's Tale, and I picked up the new Ghost Rider number one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So this is, Marvel's doing this thing now where they legacy number their books. So this would be legacy number 247 for Ghost Rider. So this book, so if everybody remembers, I was pretty annoyed a while back. Marvel dropped off and canceled the Ghost Rider series. So it was a little, I was a little taken aback by that. So, you know, they're having to establish everything over again with Ghost Rider, where Johnny Blaze is at the moment and everything. So this first issue is really just kind of defining what's happening with Johnny, which is interesting because basically we pick up with Johnny Blaze after he was battling his brother Danny. We don't know what happened there. We're just walking away from that storyline here, kids. but it starts out and Johnny's living what appears to be the perfect life. He's got the wife, the kids, the job. But he, in the storyline, he recently wrecked his motorcycle and he's dealing with issues of psychosis and injury. And he's, you know, here's one of the things with Johnny Blaze that they talked about quite a bit over the years in the books, is he is a horrible, horrible alcoholic. They really, really drive home this concept in this book that, you know, Johnny's a mess. You know, Johnny Blaze is not your, you know, superhero good guy. You know, it really drops you right into the middle of Johnny's messed up personality. And it's, you know, it's him heavily drinking in order to just be able to get through the try and sleep through the night. It opens up with him talking to a psychiatrist, and Johnny's having these visions. He's seeing things, these horrible creatures, these demons, monsters, and it's him trying to make sense of this stuff. But you know, the psychiatrist has got him, you know, kind of chanting this mantra, that there are no monsters, blah blah blah, all this, and you know, his mind is basically erased from the idea that the Ghost Rider is not there. We very quickly start to figure out that Johnny's not right in the head. It kind of alludes to the fact that he butchers his neighbor's dog and shoves it in the mailbox.
Oh, man.
Yeah. You know, there's this little old lady with this little yappy dog next door that, you know, they find the dog all diced up in the mailbox and everything. We have an interlude with the FBI as far as, like, S.H.I.E.L.D. has been folded into the FBI, and we have this character who is, you know, who was part of the supernatural wing for S.H.I.E.L.D., who is now employed by the FBI, and she's not used to playing by the FBI's rules, you know. So she's basically telling them, you know, I hunt monsters is what I do. Johnny is a mechanic. Him and Crash Simpson have a little auto shop. And then we cut over to this dark figure walking into the city. You know, this pleasant little city, Hayden Falls, where Johnny's living. And he starts doing, you know, horrible things. I mean, he's got these big sharp teeth, long claw fingernails, and you know, there's all these crows following him around. So, but Johnny keeps seeing more and more visions of like this, just horrid things. He sees his psychiatrist as this horrible creature. His bike has not been repaired. You know, he's chanting this mantra that there's no such thing as monsters. There's no such thing as monsters. But he keeps seeing everybody around him as monsters. And basically this dark figure, Zeb, lets him know that he's being lied to and that none of this is real and that he's kind of being held in this prison-esque, basically the whole town is a bunch of demons. And you know, Zeb helps Johnny trigger the Rider, and you know, Ghost Rider busts out and does what Ghost Rider does. He starts, you know, taking out the demons, and we're left with, you know, Johnny riding off into the sunset to try and figure out what's going on and why he's there. But I like this whole thing. You know, there's no such thing as monsters. He keeps repeating this mantra over and over again. Yeah. Until finally at the end of the book, where he says, the only thing I know for certain is this, there is such a thing as monsters, and I'm the worst one of all. So, you know, it really dives into a very dark place quickly. This is definitely not a kid's book.
Yeah.
You know, blood, guts, butchered dogs, you know, all kinds of weird stuff going on. There's a couple things in the book that I'm not 100% about. Like, at one point, there's a character shown in, let me see if I can find this page right quick. Here we are. There's a character shown right here on this page. This guy right here.
Yeah.
He looks like a character from the Midnight Sun series called Skinner.
Yeah, he just I've has seen that him look. Before.
Yeah, he has that look to him, but he doesn't have the blades coming out of his arms and stuff. So, you know, what is this crazy little demon-run city that Johnny's in, and how did he get there, are all questions I have. And, you know, the new issue, I believe, is coming out or has come out. I don't know yet. I got to get up to the comic book shop and scoop it up. But, you know, I'm really hopeful for this. I really am. Yeah. It dives back into the old school, well, for me, the old school darkness of Ghost Rider, and, you know, the idea that Johnny Blaze is not a good person. Yeah. You know, he's kind of this messed up, screwed up guy. This was written by Benjamin Piercy. The art is Corey Smith. Coloring by Brian Valenza, and then what the heck was that?
I don't hear anything.
I don't know. The letters was Travis Lanham. Sorry, I think one of my Alexas just went off for some bloody reason.
Oh, you need to
that
stop?
Was creepy.
We need to
that
stop?
Was creepy. I'm sitting here in the dark talking about evil horror comics and all the voices in the background. That was wild. But fantastic first issue. I'm really looking forward to see what they do. And fingers crossed they don't cancel it without finishing this time.
Yeah.
You know? Marvel really ticked me off last time when they just kind of they cut off the series. So I'm really hoping that they keep going with this one, because it would be nice to get an idea of what the heck is going on with Ghost Rider.
Now, you were talking about the other series. I mean, they just cut that off and never finished it anywhere else?
Yeah, they just cut it off. It was really upsetting. I mean, you know, I wasn't real thrilled with the way that series was going, honestly, because, you know, Danny became the spirit of pestilence or something. Yeah. I don't remember. It was weird. And the costume design for Danny was, I'll be honest, subpar.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really, grabbing me that great. Johnny was kind of on this murderous rampage across America, hunting demons as the king of hell. So the last series was a little wonky. This one nicely brings you right back into the dark, dark world of Ghost Rider.
Yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to this. I hope this is something that we're going to get to see continue and carry on. 'Cause like I said, it's not. Ghost Rider's not fluffy bunny material here,
right.
Guys.
Yeah.
You know, so holy crap! Actually, I'm looking good. It looks like we might be up to issue 5 on this thing already. Holy cow! I need to get to the comic book shop.
Yeah, when you're talking about I'm not familiar with this stuff, but when you mentioned the character Zeb, I was looking him up, and because for some reason it sounded familiar. I kept thinking, have I read about this before? Well, looking at the picture, no, I have not. I don't know why it's striking a memory to me, but this article saying Ghost Rider's hellish new ally could become Marvel's John Constantine. I will say he is, there's something about him that is disturbing. He's, but I kept thinking he was in another series I had read, but I'm wrong.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing. It's like at first when I saw him, I kind of thought he, you know, might be some kind of incarnation of like Blackout or something like that. But I'm not real sure where they're going with that character. Like I said, I only have the first issue so far. So it's kind of a wait and see where this guy goes. So, but you know, as far as him being like Marvel's version of John Constantine, I feel like Marvel's already done that with other characters before, and in the Ghost Rider mythos, Caretaker was really kind of a stand-in-esque character for John Constantine in the earlier books. So, or earlier books, I'm talking about like the 90s. So, yeah. But you know, the Zeb character. I mean, if he's killed off, no tears are going to be shed by me because, you know, so far he's got one issue under his belt and, wait a minute. Oh, no. That was Constantine that was introduced then. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, he's obviously, you know, probably some master of the mystical arts like Doctor Strange,
yeah.
Which we've seen plenty of those characters come and go over the years with the Ghost Rider series. So, you know, we'll see where we go with this guy.
It sounds cool. I do have a couple of questions on Ghost Rider. I thought, I guess I just assumed if something happened to his bike, he could just fix it.
Well, see, that's the thing. Johnny, like, as in their human forms, the Ghost Riders don't just, like, fix their bikes. The Ghost Rider, though, once they're in the Ghost Rider form, they can basically touch a broken motorcycle and just turn it back into the Hell Cycle.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Which Johnny does. He does do in this book. He does not repair, you know, he doesn't take the time to fix up the bike and, you know, make sure it's all nice and running. He basically just walks over to the busted up bike in the garage, puts his hand on it, and boom, Hell Cycle, ready to roll. So, which I believe is something I've seen done in the past. If I recall, I've even seen Ghost Rider himself crash the Hell Cycle and then reform it. Back together, you know, without any, you know, real efforts.
Yeah, well, that's in this early 70s when I read a couple of issues, I thought he could do that. But that's what you're talking about. Sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, it's kind of one of those things. Psychologically, here Johnny is. He gets everything he ever wanted in his life. He gets the girl. He gets the job. He gets the good life. Gets the kids. Mm. And somewhere inside of his head, he's still trying to ruin it all. You know, he's this very self-destructive. Mm. Johnny Blaze is his own worst enemy. You know, that's why I think we've seen for so many years him, you know, travel the world and travel, you know, alone. You know, from the end of the original Ghost Rider Johnny Blaze series till the Danny Kench series where he reappears hunting the Rider, you know, he had that time with the Carnival, and he lived, I mean, you know, a good life working in the Carnival and stuff. But there's still, you know, there was still that impending darkness at that time. And then, you know, once the Ghost Rider was reintroduced in Danny and things moved forward, you know, Johnny has never been free of the Ghost Rider and its curse since. So, you know, we've seen him, you know, become the Rider, become the King of Hell, leave Hell to hunt demons, at one point, you know, early on in the Danny Kench series, he had the Hellfire shotgun, which was the only thing that could hurt the Rider. And then he gets butchered by Lilith's kin, and he's just bleeding Hellfire out of all of the holes that they cut into him until he has, like, cybernetic implant. You know, this was the 90s. You know, everything had to have cybernetics.
Right.
he ends up with like the cybernetic cable eye patch and arm and leg, you know, to cover up and contain the hellfire pouring from his body. Good times. But now we're back into this this kind of dark, you know, like I said, self-destructive man on a mission, even though he has no idea what his mission is. So, you know, it's going to be an interesting ride no matter what, because it always is with Ghost Rider. You know, I question whether or not Ghost Rider is the character to have a continuing, ongoing series.
Yeah.
I think he's better off in miniseries, in, you know, one-shots, things like that. As I understand, the Robbie Reyes Ghost Rider, the one who drives the Charger, has been a supporting character in the Avengers series for quite some time now and is doing very popular over there. I have all those books. I just simply haven't read them because, you know, life.
Right.
But I'm going to get around to that. You know, for me, the Ghost Rider is Johnny Blaze or Danny Kench. You know, growing up the way I did around motorcycles, motorcycle culture, I like my Ghost Rider riding a motorcycle.
Right, right.
You know, don't get me wrong, the Charger's cool. There's no motorcycle.
Yeah, I remember when you were talking about those books, I ended up getting that first issue just because I liked some of the graphics and title design. Like when you open the page up, you know, it'd show the dashboard.
Yeah,
it was neat.
The Robbie Reyes Ghost Rider, the graphic design behind that book was absolutely fantastic. It was well thought out, well planned.
Yeah.
You know, the cool thing with this book is you just dive right in and you just go storyline. And you don't even get the splash page with the credits until after the final page.
That looks good, too.
You know, it's, you know, I dig what they did with this book. I mean, you know, it leaves a lot of mystery to the character. You know, how did he end up in this city? What happened? You know, where's Danny? You know, where's his brother? You know, he's, like I said, he's off on a mission now, and he's going to go mess some people's days up. But why? What's the reason? You know, other than the fact that he just knows that he's been shoved in this weird, you know, psychological prison or a physical prison by demons on Earth. You know, and that's the crazier part is the fact that there's an entire town of demons on Earth. He's not in hell. He's on Earth being held in this prison of the mind by these demons.
Yeah.
So there's a big question mark about what's been happening in the underworld in hell that all of these guys are able to, you know, run around and create this little city for themselves and, you know, hold the biggest threat to their existence as a prisoner. A lot of question marks. A lot of things probably won't get answered because they never really do with Ghost Rider. You know, it's a great book, well written, well drawn. The artwork is fantastic. You know, they hearken when he does finally transform towards the end of the book, they use the elements from multiple incarnations of the writer. You know, he's kind of got the button front jacket on.
Yeah.
He's got that button front jacket, but he's got the spikes from the 90s era. He's got spiked elbows, spiked elbows, which is a piece that was used in the later Danny Kench series when he put on the weird super colorful suit and then used again when it was the Danny Kench Ghost Rider versus the Johnny Blaze Ghost Rider, where Danny was collecting all the powers of the various spirits of vengeance across Earth. So they did a heck of a good job designing the character of the rider himself. And, you know, Johnny in the book, he looks like Johnny. He looks like Johnny Blaze, but with short hair. But they very quickly can establish how messed up this guy is. I mean, you know, we're what, 1, 2, 3, 5 pages in, and the man's reaching for a bottle of Jack Daniels. You know, like I said, that's Johnny Blaze. Johnny Blaze is a messed up dude. He is an alcoholic. He uses alcohol to not deal with the problems that are affecting him. You know, there's a reason why in the books, a lot of times they start out with Johnny in a bar. It's because he's a drunk. You know, he, like I said, Johnny means well, but he's not a good person. And like I said, this book leaves him in a position where he is off on a mission, even though he has no idea what that mission is. Mm. So, you know, he's got to piece it all together here now. So, you know.
The whole time you're talking about this, I keep remembering back in the summer of 74 when my cousin and I were picking up some of these. The big books was Master of Kung Fu and Ghost Rider. And I just remember he was kind of a carny cowboy.
Yeah.
That was trying to deal with the fact that this was his life now. I mean, you know, this is 70s comics, and it's kind of light, but he was carrying a burden. But, I mean, they really added and fleshed the character out. He seems really real now. I mean, you know, at the time, it seemed real to me. I felt for him when I was a kid, but I don't know. I'm sorry he's having so much trouble.
Well, a lot of his trouble is of his own making, you know. I mean, the Johnny Blaze character can be very arrogant and single-minded. He believes he's right no matter what he's doing. So he has the power to do what he plans to do, and whether he's right or wrong, he's going to go ahead and just do it, you know. He's a great character, and I think he's very underutilized, and he's not been written well, except for very few instances. Garth Ennis did a fantastic run with Ghost Rider, more focused on the history of the rider than the psychological breakdown of the host, of Johnny Blaze. It looks right now, the way this book starts out, I really think that Benjamin Percy is writing this character in a way that, you know, we might see how flawed he really is, how broken this man is, you know, because everything good in his life has been taken away from him. And here he is in a position in this little town, you know, granted it's being run by the bad guys, it's being run by monsters, but he can't accept the good life that he has. And that's one of the things that I think, you know, like I said, he's self-destructive. So he's a fascinating character to me. And I really look forward to seeing where the writer takes the character.
Yeah. That's interesting. One of the things you said was about, ongoing series to limited series. You know, that's something, I've been enjoying some of the series that come out, and I don't know if they were canceled or if they were never meant to keep going. Hawkeye, the David Aja Hawkeye.
Mm-hmm.
That one went on for so long, and then it finished. It kind of wrapped up. Scarlet Witch, there was a 12-issue Scarlet Witch series that James Robinson wrote, and it was a different artist each issue. David Aja did the covers. I love that. And there was Javier Pulido drawn She-Hulk series. And recently, I just talked about the last episode, there was a Thing series with Walter Mosley and Tom Riley.
Mm-hmm.
It was 5 or 6 issues. But it's like they're kind of trades and single issues. I kind of like it when you have a series that is only going to be on for so long and then stops.
Yeah. Yeah, I really enjoy those as well. And I think, you know, it's hard to break down the human aspects of a character when you're, you know, the person itself, when you're doing a long running series.
Yeah.
You know, and then when the creative team changes over and you see, you know, you see things bounce around and move and, you know, the characters' personalities change so deeply, you know, that's one of the things that's why I think he did such a good job in writing this first book or this first issue. Like I said, if you pay attention to Ghost Rider, like I said, Johnny Blaze he's a flawed human being. He is a disaster of a person. That he means well, but he just the things inside of him, his thought processes are broken in a way because he just he's lived this really messed up life.
Yeah.
You know, seeing everybody he loves and cares for die or become victims to his choices. So, you know, it's you know, like I said, it's a great jump off point, and I'm very interested to see where he ends up going with this. So, and I am noticing that this writer Benjamin blah blah blah. Yeah, let me talk. Benjamin Piercy, he's writing a couple other books. He's working on X-Force, Wolverine, Moon Knight. He's working on he's done Moon Knight, Black, White, and Blood. Pardon me. Excuse me. So you know, he's written quite a few books. So you know, it's it'll be fun to see where he takes his character and how long his run on the book is planned for. I don't know, but I'm here for it. I'm definitely here for it.
Nice one. Well, I'm just going to bring up at the end a book. I like Paul Grist. Paul Grist did the series Jack Staff. He did another series called Kane, which is about a policeman in New Eden, which is supposed to be bringing it back, but I haven't seen anything since. I really like Paul Grist. Years ago, actually before I had met you, I found in the dollar box Burglar Bill.
Okay.
Paul Grist had his own... Yeah, I do too. He had a series. He had his own publishing company called Dancing Elephant in England, and then Image Comics contacted him and said, "Would you be interested in going to Image?" Well, yeah, of course. And that's when Jack Staff switched to color. They printed some really nice trades of Jack Staff, which I think are fantastic. Everybody should go out and buy them. Kane is fantastic. Burglar Bill was an old strip that I guess he had done in an anthology. Anyway, I finally tracked down the series.
Oh, nice.
And Burglar Bill's been in... he was in Kane as a secondary character at one point. He just kind of turns up. But he's a young man that's a burglar. Even though that's a terrible thing, he seems like an okay guy, and he's got really bad luck. things tend to happen around him, and he's kind of there. They focus on some of the police. I really enjoy the thing. What gets me was it never finished. I guess, and what makes the series neat was he has old versions of it. You know, it's like the original story he did when he was young. They'll in the backup strips, he'll publish them. So you get to see different versions of it and how he's changed it. At one point, he was an older man that looked like a secondary character in one of those Wallace and Gromit cartoons. He was pear-shaped and kind of thick. And, like I said, he's a young man, but all these things are happening around him. Saying that, I really enjoyed the series, even though it doesn't really wrap up, because I was thinking, well, I got another issue to find, and there's not one. Nevertheless, I highly recommend the series. I really Paul Grist is just one of those people that he's got his own style. He's got a simple style. When I say this, it's way off the mark, but the closest thing I think of is the Batman animated series kind of style, which is something I really like. But Jack Staff was so much fun, and he's got versions of British superheroes like the Claw, which is the thief that could turn invisible, but he had a basically a claw gauntlet that I guess didn't turn invisible. He's got some of his own versions of these characters that appear in the strip. And not being English, I read a little bit about them, and I feel like I'm reading these old serials. I love his compositions, how he lays pages out, and the stories just flow. And Jack Staff, he did 12 issues under Dancing Elephant, and they were black and white. And when he came to Image, he put out an unbelievable trade. It says, Jack Staff, everything used to be in black and white, and it's staggering. It's a big, thick phone book. After that, Jack Staff was in color. I guess the only thing I'd say was, I guess it must not have been selling well because he stopped doing it. And Kane kind of did finish, even though he's coming back to it. He started another one under Image called Mudman, which I enjoyed just as much, and he didn't finish that either, so... People, go out and buy some of these comics like you did Valerian so we can read the rest of it.
Yeah, right? I mean, come on, guys.
But nevertheless...
Why are you listening to anybody but us for your comic book recommendations?
I used to ride Rook so hard. Would somebody buy Valerian? So I was scared to death that they'd only put so many issues like they did back in the early 80s and I never get to read anymore. But it sold well. A lot of people, none of my friends, but a lot of people listened to it. And they did buy it and put out what I think was a great movie that didn't do well and everybody complains about, but a lot of loved it. But all the Valerian issues came out in English, and I am a happy man. I'm so happy that I bought them twice. I bought them in the softback versions, and then I bought the hardback collections. So, anyway.
That's how you support a comic book artist, a creator. You buy everything.
Well, the hardbacks I was going to buy, but the first one printed the first Valerian story where he met Laureline in the 14th century France. I'd always heard about it. It ran in Tintin magazine or Pilot magazine. I'm saying it with an American pronunciation. But I guess they printed that first story once back in the 60s. Anyway, in the hardback they printed, I wanted to read it. It wasn't as good as the other ones, but I still enjoyed it. And then when I read, I think it was the second or third story, I found out that the American version, they cut out 22 pages. And even though I did like the version I read, it's a lot better when you read the whole story. Those 22 pages they cut out were brilliant, and anyway, a lot of back matter that they, in them, so I just decided I'll bite the bullet and buy all the hardbacks, and they're terrific. So anyway, if you love something, you don't mind buying it twice.
Exactly. So.
Anyway, thanks for sticking it out with us. This has been fantastic. I'm trying to get a straight thought here. We use fake comic book covers for the Facebook page and the Facebook group to announce a new episode. If you would like to do one, just send it to the contact page or even just contact us and tell us you'd like to do it. The only thing we ask is we just use it, the title of it just says comics. You can either put it on yourself or send it and I'll put it on. just leave a space for the show number and the Cyclops icon. And we use artists for music breaks. We're always struggling to get them, except for today, because we found that artist that I can't remember her name all of a sudden. Anyway, if you'd like to do something, you have it, just send us a MP3, and we'd be glad to put it on the music break and add a link to your site on the blog. Anything you got, Rook?
Guys, make sure you go check out our t-shirts and other wonderful things hopefully we've got coming down the pipe. Check out our YouTube channel that we have failed to post on multiple times. We'll get around to it, I swear. But, you know, life is crazy. Life is busy. Don, I just want to say thank you again for, you know, doing two great interviews, two amazing creators. You know, I look forward to, you know, doing so many more episodes. And, you know, I appreciate you holding on with me for all the crazy.
Oh, hey, listen, just remember that when it happens to me.
Will do.
So anyway, everybody, thank you very much for listening. And in the meantime,
read
more
comics!